I'll try to do better.
No, that's good.
You're listening to Please Be Reasonable, where we seek to speak humbly and passionately about things that matter and things that don't.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Please Be Reasonable. I'm your co-host, Sam.
And I'm your co-host, Josh.
Josh, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good.
It's good to be with you, man. We're chilling out in your house.
Yep.
Doing our thing.
That's right.
Not super late. No guests tonight. Just me and you. Just back to the dream team. Just Sam and Josh sitting around talking about things.
And topics.
Yeah.
So
cool.
What's up?
What's going on in my life? Can I tell you a story?
Please do.
I want to know, first off, your reaction to this, and second off, if you've ever done this. So, here in St. Louis, it's officially getting warm, right? We've broke 90 a couple times already. So, it's getting warm. And you know this, but I drive a lot for my work. I'm in a car a lot. And so, the other day, I'm working, I'm driving, I'm going along. I was actually out in St. Charles. Driving along, doing my deal, just got off the highway. And lo and behold, from where the windshield meets the headliner of the car, right? So that little gaplet up here by your rearview mirror, out crawls a little spider bro who'd taken up residence in my car, who was so large. Josh, so large. This spider, Josh, the spider, was... it was probably about this big.
So
I mean, so that's like
about a quarter, size of a quarter?
No,
half,
Josh,
dollar.
That's significantly larger than a quarter right there. That's like two quarters.
A two quarter spider.
And he was fuzzy and I could see his little eyeballs. And he turned around and just looked at me. And I was driving at relatively high speeds during this process. And so I did what any sane, rational human being would do. I screamed like a little girl and put on my emergency flashers and slammed on the brakes and pulled over to the side of the road and then got out of the car on the shoulder and reached in and squished him with my shoe, which, with people driving by watching a grown man standing outside his car reaching in with his shoe, it was a pretty terrible experience all around. Just all accounts, everything about it was pretty awful. You ever had that happen, Josh?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, sometimes, you know, there's little mosquitoes that get stuck in your car, and I end up, like, slapping at the dash, trying to get it, and still drive carefully. And Emily's like, hey, just drive. But then, I don't know.
What do you think about the spider, though? Do you think my response was justified?
I mean, if it's not a poisonous spider, then...
Well, first off, Josh, I'm not qualified to identify whether or not it was a poisonous spider, so I feel like that's a really, really non-beneficial standard.
Okay, so
I'm driving down the highway like, wait, hold on, little spider bro.
So
let me check the markings on your back.
To the spider.
What?
You're applying Pascal's wager to the spider.
Please explain.
You don't know if it's poisonous or not. But the drawback, if it is, and it's not poisonous, I mean, if it is poisonous and you don't do anything about it, that's much worse than if it's not poisonous and you kill it anyway.
Here's the deal. I actually didn't care about the poison at all. The main thing I was concerned about was whether or not this spider bro was friendly. And here's what I mean by friendly. I don't want a friendly spider in my presence. Because a friendly spider... is going to see you. He's a little spider bro. He eats bugs. He keeps your life happy. And he's going to be like, hey, human, thanks for creating an environment that attracts bugs that I can eat and make your life easier. We have a symbiotic relationship. Let's be friends. Let me hug you. And the minute that friendly spider wants to come over and fist bump me or give me a hug or do some little spider bro cuddles and make any sort of physical contact with my body, relationship over. Unacceptable. That's where I draw the line. And so my main concern was this fuzzy little spider looked me right in the eyeball, and he had that look of a friendly little spider bro. that was like, let's be friends. And I'm like, this ain't going to happen.
You know, I don't think I've ever had that level of an emotional connection with an invertebrate.
Oh, man, that was the dumbest intro ever. Anyway, so tonight we're totally changing course from what we talked about last time. So I want to explain this to you listeners real quick. We talked about a series of episodes kind of starting with this concept of dating and courtship and working our way through homeschool culture and talking about patriarchy and Christian culture. And that is still going to happen, but we have a series of interviews that we need to line up that we didn't line up well enough. It just didn't work out with scheduling and those things. And
basically, we're trying to take it slow, not move too fast on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing when you're talking about dating is you don't want to commit too fast. You know what I mean? Like, you don't want to give part of yourself away to a topic before you know if it's going to...
It's only been like 3 weeks since we last met the topic, so we don't want to hang out too much with it too fast.
I think the biggest thing with a topic for a podcast is you have to play hard to get. Like, if you just keep coming back to a topic week after week, you seem kind of desperate, right?
Kind of needy.
Yeah, and what topic wants a needy podcast host?
None.
Anyway.
Strike two.
Oh, we're two for two tonight on crappy things to talk about. So anyway, we're taking a little break from that. We are going to come back to that series of podcasts. We think that'll be really good. We just need to get some stuff lined up with getting some people to talk about it. So we're going to actually jump to a topic that Agnostic Andy suggested to us, both in our interview and then through an email conversation. So what are we talking about tonight, Josh?
We are talking about morality.
Morality.
Specifically, morality without God.
Is it possible?
Josh, it's possible.
How could you have a morality without God?
What do you mean?
I mean, I am only moral because God tells me to be. So if you take God out of the equation, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, atheists should just be raving murderers, right? Killing everybody in sight?
Can I present a moral quandary to you really quick before we get started?
This
happened to me in real life.
But will this like consume my thoughts for the rest of the podcast as I try to resolve it?
I want to know how you would resolve this as a Christian.
Sam, you shouldn't have killed the spider.
I want to know how you would resolve this as a Christian and then how you'd resolve it if you're an atheist. So that's what we'll do. So I'm at the store, Shop and Save specifically.
Yep.
Because sometimes Aldi just doesn't have what I need. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes I have needs and the other stores can't meet them. So I go to Shop and Save because it meets my needs.
You gotta adjust your needs to the Aldi. But carry on.
Anyway, I needed avocados. We were making guac.
Your Aldi doesn't have avocados?
No, it does, but they were all like super bright green and I wanted to make guac that night.
Oh, okay.
I needed immediate guac satisfaction.
I didn't mean to sound so judgmental.
Yeah, it's cool. I just get it.
Keep
you're
going.
Actually a better person than I am, Josh, so I'm really used to that.
You're saying I'm more moral?
Exactly. So here's the scenario for real. This actually really happened to me. So I've got a screaming toddler with me who is not happy about making a second grocery store trip. We go in to buy the avocados, and all the lines are busy, so I go through the self-checkout. I pay for my avocados, take the screaming kid out to the car. As I'm getting her in her car seat, I just so happen to look at my receipt and realize I didn't pay for one of my avocados.
Because
it was self-checkout. You just typed in a number.
Wow.
I know.
Yep.
So I stole an avocado from Shop and Save.
You didn't go back to correct it?
Well, that's the question. I will tell you what I did, but I want to know first, if you're in this scenario, screaming toddler, you're already out in the parking lot.
Yeah.
You got the bag. Kid's already in the car seat. What are you doing? What are you doing?
What I do is make a mental note that next time I go, tell him to ring me up for an extra avocado.
Are you serious?
I don't know. I mean, that hypothetical situation has so many specific factors that, you know, affect your, like, tension to not take the time to go back in with everything that, like, I don't know how I would respond if I was exactly there. I probably wouldn't notice the receipt till I got back, actually.
So say you get home and then you realize you stole an avocado. What's going on?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I did that once at Aldi. And I told them about the next time, and they were like, oh, okay, whatever. It's fine. So apparently that is what I would do, because that's what I did.
Okay. Well, I took my daughter back inside and paid for the avocado, and the checkout lady actually was mad at me and was like, your kid wants to go home. Why did you come inside to pay for another avocado? So, so I don't know. Maybe we were both terrible at that.
Yeah.
So morality.
Morality.
It's a sticky thing. We all got it. Every human being's got some form of morality, right? We just don't all agree on what it should look like.
And we have variations in our ability to live up to our own moralities.
Yeah. So I think what's interesting here when we're talking about morality, specifically in the context of like an atheist or a secular culture versus a religious or a religious person or religious culture, is essentially the idea that in the majority of religious contexts, your moral code is assigned to you, right? The religion bears with it a moral code. And so you are handed it and expected to assent to it, which can lead to its own set of issues, right? And so the idea then becomes, well, can you independently construct a moral code? Do you need a religious system to hand you one? Like, do you need something outside yourself to construct a moral code?
And this is important to talk about. We were kind of joking a few minutes ago about how can you have morals without a God, without being a Christian? And I think it's important to talk about because it's a very common conception in Christian culture that there is no moral code at all without a God. And people are really surprised to find that atheists have some kind of moral code, and atheists are really sick of that assumption from Christians. So I think it's important to kind of explore that a little bit.
Well, it's funny you say that, because there's one outspoken atheist who likes to make a joke about this, and I want to play an audio clip here really quick. This is Penn Jillette. Do you know who this is?
Yeah, the entertainer guy / kind of libertarian atheist.
He's a magician.
Yeah, that's the word I meant.
Penn of Penn and Teller. But he has this pretty famous video clip that's made its rounds of him talking about this exact issue of Christians telling him that because he's an atheist, he doesn't have morality, or how can he have a moral code and those things. And obviously, this dude is an entertainer and kind of a comedian, and so it's humorous. So I want to play it.
One of the things that we end up doing when we're defending atheism is we end up talking about morality. We end up talking about how can someone be moral without God? How can someone be moral without a supreme being looking over them for reward and punishment? They're always talking about that morality, and can we have it without God? And my favorite question, and when I talk to, you know, religious groups, I get this all the time, and I wait for it because I have an answer. Some of the other ones I, you know, kind of try to avoid. It's very important, you'll notice this later. I want to give you also a little bit of an insight into show business. When we go to the Q&A period in about a half an hour or so, you'll notice that I always answer the question I want to answer and not the question that's asked. The most important thing you can learn in public speaking. But they will stand up and they will ask, if there is no God, what stops you from raping and killing everyone you want to rape and kill? What stops you from doing that? And my answer is always, you're absolutely right. I have raped and killed every single person I want to rape and kill. And that number is zero!
Yeah. So, yeah, he describes it, kind of this common misconception. And I think there's a couple of reasons why a lot of Christians have that idea, especially Christians that don't really know any atheists or have friends with people outside of Christian culture. There's a couple of things. One has to do with what your moral code is, and then two has to do with your ability to live up to your moral code. Because for the Christian, our moral code is so tied up with God and the Bible and theology and all of that, and this idea that we are inherently selfish, sinful humans with a sinful nature, so that without it, we would just behave selfishly.
Yeah, it's interesting. In a Christian morality, biblically speaking, like in the New Testament, there is the assumption that you lack the ability to actually uphold the moral code given to you, which is pretty interesting. An impossible standard built into the system.
Yeah, I mean, Romans 7, Paul saying, I do what I do not want to do. The good that I wish to do, I find myself unable to do it. The things that I don't want to do, I find myself doing. And, I mean, that's something that strongly resonates with me.
Yeah, absolutely.
We desire to do good things, but we are unable to live up to it, which for the Christian ties into both our need for a savior and the power of Jesus saving you and the Spirit helping you become better. So I think a lot of times for the Christian, if you take that away, one, there's, you have this idea. So for the Christian, one, if you take away a God, then you take away that moral code. And so you're left, like, you don't have a code to follow. And then secondly, you don't have any supernatural power helping you overcome your own desires either. So I think that kind of leads to the conception that, someone who's not a Christian should have no morals, basically. But there are, we'll talk about some moral codes that atheists develop. But there's also just, even in lieu of having some kind of moral code, even just following, a selfishness, there's still limits on, there's factors that would limit someone's behavior. There's your own conscience, which Christians tend to affirm that everyone has a conscience. Even other religions that develop moral systems, there's people argue for inherent morality based on universal morals that people have in their conscience that they believe is wrong. And if you're acting selfishly even if your only desire is to do what makes you feel good, if doing certain immoral things make you feel bad, then you're not going to do them or try not to do them.
Yeah.
There's also influences of society, of your peers. If other people around you discourage you from doing something, you may be less likely to do it. And then obviously the legal system. You may want to kill someone, but you don't want to go to jail for it. And that's what society will do. So you limit your behavior in that sense.
Yeah, see that. So again, So this is kind of the problem I have with like Penn's response, right? So obviously he's making a joke, so it's not the end of the world. But I love what you just said of, okay, so maybe you want to kill someone, but the law stops you. Like I think there's something important to remember there, because he makes this in his joke, he makes this grand statement, I've murdered everyone I want to murder. Okay, well that sounds awesome and sounds really high and mighty and thoughtful and caring for human society and those things. But in the same breath, we are insanely emotional creatures, and there are things that engage us passionately enough in the moment to desire to do harm to others.
Yeah. And well,
it just seems foolish to me to deny that, to say that you've never wanted to harm someone. Really, Penn? Really?
Well, I think it, even if he never did, what about someone else that did?
Yeah.
And did harm someone? Like I feel like his response is a response to kind of this simplified Christian idea that without God, everyone should be completely terrible. And, people like Penn say, hey, I'm not terrible. I don't even want to do those terrible things. But
yeah, and then he says, and if you do go to prison, get out of our society.
But at the same time, there are some people that do. And I feel like a lot of times I see, like, online, when the topic of somebody doing terrible things comes up, then there's just kind of this response, like, he kind of alludes to this, oh, well, go to jail, get the F out of our society.
Yeah.
Like, there's this kind of, like, contemptful response of, oh, you're a terrible person that did this terrible thing. But that's kind of like, that's the end of it. Like, that's all you can say.
Yeah. I think part of this is the tension between the demographic of a religious and specifically a Christian worldview and the demographic of an atheistic worldview. You and I talked about this a little bit off air, but I've read in several different places, and I have no idea how the heck you would actually confirm this, but I've read in several different places that atheists tend to be more consistent in actually living out their moral code because they independently, like, assented to their moral code. Like, whatever their moral code is, like, they've thought through it and they've assented to it. And, like, there's something about that process that makes it more practical and more doable for them. And I kind of hear that in Penn's response, right? Where he's like, you know, hey, like, if that's what you think, like, sign up for prison, get out of my society sort of thing. But I think this is a demographic difference where, especially when you're talking about the gospel message, there's what you already said, this truth that we say, hey, morality is unobtainable. You need salvation. You need the help of the Holy Spirit, which is going to attract people of lower moral fiber. That's going to attract people who feel at tension with their inner morality and their lack of ability, right? Like their nonconformity to social norms of morals. Like, they're going to hear that message and be empowered by that to go, hey, I'm not good at this, but there's someone that will help me, that will forgive me for my moral failings and will help me to, like, to grow in this area. And so I think a Christian worldview tends to attract people who are already wrestling with that, whereas an atheistic worldview is attracting people who are already thinking through and maybe more consistent with their moral code, which is weird to think about, right?
Yeah, I find it interesting to think about interaction between, like, the atheist moral view, which we'll get into a little more later, like humanism and different ideas, atheist morality for doing good to each other, and the interaction between that and, like, the sinful harming person,
you know, yeah,
the criminal, the violent, and, like, how they would interact with that person on morality.
Yeah.
And, like, I used to have kind of this Christian chip on my shoulder, like, thinking that Christian morality was clearly superior to that, like, atheist moralities, because, you know, we say we have this objective morality that's backed by God. And,
heck,
like,
yes,
like, it's, like,
stamp of approval.
It's truth. Like, it is, like, these are, like, right and wrong. And the atheist just has their own subjective ideas. So, you know, I can say to the murderer, like, what you are doing is wrong. Like, according
to God,
this is
an eternal affront before a holy and righteous God.
Like, it's this objective truth.
Yeah.
That, whereas the atheist would have to, like, I'm assuming, because I, you know, and this may be false assumption, but, you know, I'm assuming the atheist just has to say, well, this is a moral code that I've subjectively come up with that I think is best for society, but you have to persuade that person to accept it. Like, there's no, like, objective weight to it. But at the same time, I've also realized the Christian still has to persuade the person that their views are correct. Like, you, like, they both still have to persuade the person of something.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, yeah. Do you think it's less weighty to tell someone, like, hey, as a society, we've agreed that this is destructive, so you can't do it? You think that's less weighty than saying you've affronted a holy and righteous and eternal God?
On the face of it, it sounds less weighty to me. You know, obviously, yeah, that's the background that I have that makes it sound that way.
Yeah. Interesting.
On the topic of, you know, what is atheistic morality? Because there's kind of this default view that I think, and this, I think also even a lot of Christians or people who grow up Christian and leave the faith kind of wrestle with this, going into this kind of default of moral relativism, of if you're taking away a God, then there is no objective right or wrong. You just do what feels good to yourself, what you think is best. You know, basically pursuing your own well-being, in whatever way you see fit. And obviously, I guess a lot of people end up with that kind of a view. But there are, atheistic moral systems. And I think the term humanism or secular humanism is kind of a name for that, for the idea that humans should seek to, improve human society, improve the well-being of all humans, decrease the suffering of other humans, make the world a more peaceful, just, better place, preserve the ongoing of our species, all those kind of concepts. And let's see, when we had Andy on, he recommended Sam Harris, who is one of the atheist, new atheist, what do they call them, the four atheist horsemen of the apocalypse? Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens.
Sam Harris, and who's the other one?
Daniel Dennett? Is that his name? Dennett. I hadn't read his stuff. I don't know. Anyway.
He's the lame horse. He's like, he's famine. He's the one no one cares
ranked
about.
Ranked fourth. They had to make it four to make the analogy work.
Yeah.
Whoever came up with it.
Yeah. He was just like, listen, we've only got a holy trinity of atheists, but we need to make this into a four horsemen of the apocalypse thing. So who can we bump up here? Who can we bump to the next level?
Sam Harris wrote The End of Faith, Letter to a Christian Nation. But then he also wrote this book called The Moral Landscape.
Yes.
Which Andy found really insightful and inspiring to him.
And asked us to read it.
He suggested just watching the TED Talk because it was a lot shorter.
Yes.
So I did watch that, and then we kind of engaged a little bit in email to kind of draw out a little more of the value Andy sees in those ideas.
Thank you, Andy, for the suggestion, BTW.
Yes.
Our correspondent on the ground, our resident agnostic.
You've read the book before, right?
Cuddly buddy. Yes, long time ago. I barely remembered it, and so I checked it out again from Hoopla to try and refresh myself for this gathering, little recording.
How would you kind of summarize the basic ideas?
I mean, oh gosh, I'm going to do a terrible job of this. Because I don't have my notes in front of me. But I guess my whole thing is that he builds this moral code around the idea of, what's the phrase he uses?
Flourishing?
Yeah, human flourishing, right? That we should see that as an objective good, and we should seek that, and that is like a sufficient code to create organized secular society. Like, he basically gives a vision for a societal structure that is based around that as its moral basis. But it also digs into some weird stuff where it gives you freedom to, and this is, I think, a common theme amongst a lot of the new atheist guys, but it gives you the ability to objectively critique other cultural things, other cultures, things that seem important or valuable to them that we deem to be destructive to human flourishing.
Yeah, so he's pushing back on kind of the more relativism sides of atheism, saying that believing you can use science and the way science defines human flourishing to come up with an objective morality to encourage and pursue in humanity. And he uses an analogy of health that, you know,
the health.
The overall definition of health is changing, and it's even like different for different people. But just even if we don't have this objective final definition of health, we still have like an idea of, we can look and see that a certain person is more healthy than another person, and we can use science to help us become more healthy and define improvements in health and that sort of thing.
Oh, man. Really quick, we're not going down this tangent, but just try and use science to help you get more healthy. Go ahead, Google it. Google the science of getting healthy. See if that gets you anywhere.
Well, I think you're getting at that there's disagreement and all kinds of stuff out there, but there's also like truth in there that you can discern and tease out, and things that we do learn and learn more about over time.
The main one is that essential oils don't do anything. That's the main truth science is teaching us. Sorry, Emily.
Actually, Science Mike talked about essential oils once. I was actually really intrigued by his response.
What did he say?
I forget exactly because it was many months ago, but it was something about like, in general, like there aren't studies that show like positive effects, but like he thinks there's enough evidence of either anecdotally or whatever, or enough room like for the unknown in it, that like there could be positiveness to it that science hasn't like figured out or like nailed down. Something like, I probably really butchered it, but anyway.
I have no comment on that.
I just thought it was interesting from a, like, generally someone who promotes scientific consensus on everything.
Yeah. I have thoughts on, we don't have to, this is totally derailing us, but I feel like that's one of Science Mike's big weaknesses, is that he is, I feel like he says stuff like that where, like, the science comes down pretty bluntly, but he doesn't want to, like, offend his audience base, so he's like, yeah. Hey, if it's cool, like, if you dig it, man, just go for it, like. It
brings you shalom.
Yeah. I'm gonna cut that part out, because that's stupid.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not cutting out the part about how crappy essential oils are, though. So, basically, Sam Harris's whole argument is this idea that we can come up with some objective truths that are better ways for humans to live, where human life is better if it fits these categories.
And if there are places where humans are harming other humans, we can objectively call that out as wrong.
If any behavior is hindering humans reaching those objective categories, then we label those as wrong, and behavior that helps humans reach those categories, we label that as right. And so basically it just uses this standard of human good, right? So good things happen to humans. That becomes, well, I just use the word good to define what good is. Back that train up for a second. But yeah, like that's the basic idea there, is just if it's allowing a human to reach higher potential, more peace, more health, more joy, whatever, that becomes good. If it's hindering those things, that becomes bad.
Yeah. And
which I think is a really interesting thought, but I also think some of the arguments against it are pretty valid.
I think so. He got a lot of pushback from other atheists that kind of, I guess, have more like relativistic type views on morality. And he had a,
which really, did we talk about what the relativistic view on morality is?
I mean, I just briefly mentioned my own simplified conception of it. You do what feels good to you.
I don't think that's right, though.
Yeah. Make it better.
Well, so, oh man, I'm like, this is me drawing on like Dr. Stein's introduction to sociology class like 10 years ago, but
I don't mean to imply that all other atheists would only have that view.
Yeah.
But that's what Harris is pushing against.
Yeah, but I think communicating the idea of subjective morality, I think it's more societal than it is individual.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I think particular cultures develop taboos and develop things that are sacred, and that becomes a moral code. And I think the subjectiveness of it is that it's those things differ culture to culture based on a huge, like, varying number of circumstances. All sorts of different things can make certain things come across as good or sacred or important, and other things come across as taboo are bad or evil. Like a really cool study of that is like if you ever read anything about like the Pacific crate religions, cargo religions,
cargo cult.
Yeah, cargo cult. There yeah. it is. You ever read like stuff about that, right? So like these super isolated cultures develop their whole list of right and wrong, sacred and taboo, like holy and profane, based totally on their context that has nothing to do with anything seemingly objective, right? It seems silly to people outside. I think that's where the subjectiveness comes in, is isolated societies of humans use their environment to make decisions about what's right and wrong based on what seems most beneficial to that individual society.
Well, the example that Sam Harris mentions, and that I think is a big deal to Andy too, and a lot of other agnostics and atheists, is Islamic cultures where women are prohibited in a lot of ways, as far as dress and freedom of movement and education and genital mutilation. Whereas there's some, the sociological arguments that some of those are cultural things that we don't have the right to judge.
Yeah.
And they're pushing back and saying, no, to the extent that those things reduce human flourishing, we can, even from an atheistic perspective, denounce those as opposed to that.
Yeah.
And
which I think is cool. I think that's a weighty, that has some weight to it that I think I think that's worth discussing. I think that's a good argument.
Yeah. Discussion. Well, and to the point that like a sociological argument would be like, oh, someone in a different culture has different preferences and we can't impose our own preferences on them. Something that Harris said, I want to read here. This is a response on his website to, he had a contest because a lot of people were pushing back on him to select the best essay in rebuttal, and then he replied to it. He says, some people don't know what they're missing. Their existing desires and goals are not necessarily a guide to the moral landscape. It is perfectly coherent to say that all of us live to one or another degree in ignorance of our deepest possible interests. I'm sure there are experiences and models of living available to me that I really would value over all others if I were only wise enough to value them. And then, unless one were to posit against all evidence that every person's peak on this landscape is idiosyncratic and zero sum, i.e. my greatest happiness will be unique to me and will come at the expense of everyone else's, the best possible world for me seems very likely to be nearly the best possible world for everyone else. Do you think I'd be better off in a world filled with happy, peaceful, creative people? So I think that's really interesting.
I do think that's interesting. It makes me, the whole tension there between what he's stating in a more standard sociological model, I told you this off air, it makes me think of Harry Potter and Hermione and the house elves, right? How she's looking at the house elves and she has this idea that they're receiving all this unfair treatment, and if only they knew what it was like to be free and receive pay and make their own decisions, they would love it. And they basically come down on her and are like, no, we hate that. Like, that would actually make us miserable. But, like, the life that we have is what brings us joy. It's really, like it's interesting. And I actually have to confess here, I haven't read the whole series, so I don't know if she resolves that storyline differently. But where I'm at in the series, it seems that she's making an argument, J.K. Rowling, it seems that she's making an argument kind of toward that sociological thing of not assuming one culture to be better for flourishing than another, but that's different, I guess, between
I think
house elves and real human beings being denied.
Well, I think there's this tension where it may apply to some things, but then you can say, come on, genital mutilation, come on, seriously, a travesty, that's terrible. Like, how can that possibly not reduce human flourishing, no matter what your culture?
It seems like there's a line to be drawn somewhere.
And so, yeah. But I think I think there's kind of an interesting connection with what Harris is talking about there to like a Christian morality and Christian community, where he's kind of trying to connect take the drive for human selfishness and connect it to, like, the drive for your own well-being and connect it to the well-being of humanity, saying like the well-being of humanity actually is itself better for the well-being of yourself. Like,
Yeah.
And like, I feel like there's an aspect of that that is, that reminds me of like Christian community. Because, you know, sometimes there's this picture of Christianity as, you just deny yourself and you have to give up everything and no pleasure, no fun things. You know, you're sacrificing everything for everything. And I'm reminded of that verse, in the Gospels, and I should have looked it up, but where Jesus says, like, there's no one who has given up everything for my name who will not receive brothers and sisters and, mothers and fathers and houses and whatever. Like Shane Claiborne talks about that in his books, like Irresistible Revolution, where he's talking about like these communities of Christians that on the one hand, you know, give up everything, the Western dream and everything, but they also receive this community and there's this sense of growing kingdom of God and people pouring their lives out for the poor and, just like all these amazing, inspiring stories of excitement and this idea that there is, you can find a greater, a deeper, more fulfillment for your own life in pursuing like good for others and with others.
Yeah, the Christian argument, the argument I've heard for the benefit of Christian morality, have you ever heard the fence analogy? I've heard Christian theologians use this a lot. They talk about how Christian morality is restrictive, but it's restrictive in a way that is freeing. So the argument is that Christianity does require sacrifice. It requires giving, like willful giving up of privilege and willful giving up of certain experiences. But that the choice to do that actually creates a greater sense of personal fulfillment and freedom and joy. And the analogy used is like, say you had a house that backed up to the freeway and you had a huge backyard, like you wouldn't feel necessarily safe letting your kids play in that backyard because it backs up to the freeway. But the minute you put a fence up, like that fence makes like gives a safety to the yard, like it, like the boundaries of the fence allow you to enjoy the gift that the yard is. So putting boundaries around your life allow you to enjoy the gift that life is.
I feel like it's a little hokey, but I get it.
Well, gee whiz, man, just dig right in, man. Just turn the knife.
There's a community aspect to it that I think is the key.
The key. I also think. I think there's a connection here too, to when you're talking about a more reformed theology. One of the things that comes up all the time is like, you know, everything we do for the glory of God, peace, and how that can seem really, really foolish from an outsider perspective. Like, why? First off, what does that say about who God is? You know, that He wants everything to like give Him credit and glorify Him. But second off, like, what does that say about your life that you're devoting your life to giving some other creature like all the credit and all the joy? Like, I see that piece in it too, because there's this, the biblical teaching is that the glory of God like brings the greatest joy and fulfillment to humanity. And so like submitting to this Christian worldview, this seeking after the glory of God actually brings joy, life, fulfillment, peace to the individual.
Yeah. Like I said, I think it's interesting the way Harris connects the well-being of the individual to the well-being of society.
Yeah.
I think, like I said, I think there's a powerful connection to Christian community there. I also like have a concern that his view, that it kind of also kind of shows potential weakness to his view, in that, you know, he says when he talks about the moral landscape is not probably not zero sum for everyone. The best possible world for me seems very likely to be the best possible world for everyone else. But what if scientifically you found out that that wasn't true, or that for some people to have better worlds required less good for some other people? then is your scientific-based morality imposing limits on some forms of human flourishing?
This gets into like discussion about just like Western lifestyle and consumption of those things, right? Because you're talking about Sam Harris writing as a Western author who's experiencing like a Western standard of living.
Yeah. And I, you know, we really should have Andy here to give pushback on if we're really misrepresenting things here. But like what that makes me think about is I'm curious if the Christian virtue of sacrifice can play into that at all, because you might want to make other people's lives better and that makes your life better. But if it requires any sacrifice on your part, like how willing are you? And like we were talking about in Christian community, sometimes like there is sacrifice required, but it can also lead to a greater fulfillment. But
yeah, it's that cheesy fence thing, Josh.
Yeah, I guess. But if it requires sacrifice to get to a better world for everyone, it requires some people to sacrifice and no one's willing to do it, then how do you get there? I feel like there's a difference between the idea of loving your neighbor and loving your neighbor as yourself.
Ooh.
I feel like there's a lot of people in modern society that want to love their neighbors, and even want to do it better than a lot of Christians, which, as an aside, is something that I wrestle with, is good to wrestle with, and is challenging sometimes why a lot of non-religious people sometimes seem nicer than a lot of Christians.
Well, I think that goes back to what I said earlier about...
You're saying it's a selection bias effect, basically.
What?
It's a selection effect. The types of people that go into each.
Yeah.
It's a disproportional representation of what you're comparing.
Well, I also think there's just something really beautiful about the fact that if an atheist rejects a moral like structure being handed to them, they have to do the work of creating it themselves. And if you create it yourself, it seems to me you'd be more likely to give weight to it and give practice to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I just feel
and selection
like
bias.
I have this deep like upbringing of like this idea of becoming a Christian over time, you should become a better person.
Yeah.
Through following Jesus. And so when a lot of people.
So why aren't all the old Christians nice?
But.
Because sometimes they're the meanest ones.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a good question, I think. And you can come up with answers like you did, but.
Come on, oldos. Tell us what the deal is.
My. So judgmental. as I was saying, I feel like a lot of non-religious people want to love their neighbors, but I'm not sure, like, sometimes I feel like they want to love their neighbors up to the point of sacrifice for themselves. Like, not necessarily love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah.
As much as you are. Like.
Well, Harris even talks about this, right? About prioritizing yourself and your family above others. Like, that is a necessary part of the moral structure.
Yeah. Well, he says not to a, he calls it enlightened selfishness seems the most reasonable approach. I'm quoting again from that post, in which we are more concerned about ourselves and our children than about other people and their children, but not callously so.
Whereas a Christian morality would take a different approach to that. It would say you should be a minimum of equally as concerned, but most likely more concerned about the other, right?
Yeah, I mean, it does get tricky with family. It's easier at the individual level, at least, to say sacrifice yourself for the better of the other person.
Sorry, Kim. Sorry. Nope, you're going.
Because you can make arguments for various things, but even as a general principle, though, I think some beautiful forms of Christian community emerge when everyone is willing to sacrifice themselves.
Absolutely.
To different degrees. Yeah. And everyone ends up better because of it.
I think this is part of what radical Christian community looks like. Like that's what's so compelling about it, is people making choices to better others above themselves. Like that's such a rare thing in general, that when we see it, it's just like, shoot, what's going on there?
Yeah.
I feel like this is probably the most we can say about this topic at this point. And I think this is introductory. We need to get some voices of you guys as listeners and Andy to kind of rebut some of this so that we can keep the conversation going. My problem with having this discussion, Josh, I think you and I are just a little too in agreement on this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think we're both just kind of in the same place of like, Christian morality is awesome and we like it. And some atheists have morality that's cool and we like that too. The end, you know? And so it's just like, I feel like there's just not probably enough tension between us to really represent this fully. So I think this needs to be an introductory discussion and let some people push back on it and then really, really bring the conversation a little fuller and really represent other sides of it better. So please do that. Please reach out to us in this. But just kind of as a closing thought, I think it would be cool for us to try and put ourselves in the shoes of an atheist and just say, how do you think your moral code would be different if you were an atheist, if you took God out of it? What do you think you would do differently morally?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I would probably be more selfish. We probably would give away much less money. I don't know, like, I feel like I would try to be drawn to some version, like, of secular humanism. I really like the ideals of making the world a better place for humanity and, you know, the overall flourishing. I feel like I would probably still hold on to some aspect of that. I don't know, like, I don't know what kind of integrity I would maintain as far as like things that where I wouldn't, like small things where I think I wouldn't get caught, or like I would probably watch some porn, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is I wouldn't pay for the avocado. I'd be getting a free avocado every time I went to Shop and Save.
See, I don't think I would do that. I think I would have enough limits, both of conscience and like legal, like eventually getting caught. I think those would restrict.
Dude, they're not gonna catch you. It's the self checkout. They don't know.
Like, I might, like I said, I might still feel
the
like
trick is
an
to
inner,
buy five avocados and just pay for.
I might
four.
Feel an inner conscience that, like, that was not good for the flourishing of society.
Yeah, honestly, I think the biggest thing for me, and obviously this is hypothetical, is I tend towards utility in general. And I think if I was not a religious person, I think I would default to kind of a bleak, almost like Darwinian, like utilitarian sociological understanding of morality is just societally subjective, and whatever is best suited for survival in our particular society is what's most beneficial, like, and self-preservation, like what's best suited. Like I think that's where I'd go, to be honest. Just because I tend to default to utility in a lot of areas of life, like what's just going to work best, like what's going to do that. And I think that's what I would do with morality, which I think practically speaking would have a lot of the same effects. I think I'd be really self-serving. I think things that were pleasing and had low consequence, whatever that is, stealing the avocado, internet porn, whatever, like I think those things would probably be pretty rampant in my life, which sounds pretty terrible. Like, Josh, I don't like this discussion because I think I'm a pretty terrible human being.
That's why you need Jesus.
Yeah, that's the reason that I'm a Christian, is I couldn't handle it. I'm the guy Penn Jillette was making fun of, so...
Yeah, well, that's like my reaction to like kind of that non-religious contempt towards people that do terrible things. It's just like, well, they're a terrible person. They should go F themselves or whatever. And like my response is, yeah, they are terrible. They need Jesus. Like, and there's a, like a hope there.
I'm curious about this though. I wonder if a non-religious person would look at our response and just say, that's because we've been so conditioned with the concept of depravity and sin that we default to our own terribleness and that we actually might not in another setting. I'd be curious to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, whereas Christians would say Jesus is the answer, there's like the secular humanist version of education and a proper environment or whatever is the answer.
Yeah.
To making people better.
So if you had to sum up this entire discussion, what would you say?
I would say that morality is complicated, but
you should pay for the avocado.
Christians should not have simplified assumptions about how non-religious folk behave and try to behave, and should get to know some and learn a little bit more about that.
Awesome. I like it. So here's where we're starting. We're not putting a bow on it, but this is where we're going to end this part of the conversation. This is to put it out there and express some of our thoughts. Please push back. Let us know where we misrepresented things or where you just think you have a better argument or response to what we said. Contact us. Hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or email us. PBRcast@gmail.com. We want to engage you guys' thoughts on this. You want to do thing of the week real quick?
Thing it's time for. Thing of the week.
So this is a cool one. I'm going to be quick on this, but Josh, you're into Humble Beast Records, right?
I sure am.
So Humble Beast, if you are into indie music and hip hop and like.
The gospel
and like Portland culture, boom, Humble Beast is everything you love. It's hipsters and hip-hop and Jesus and organic free trade coffee all mixed together into one thing. Anyway, the guys over at Humble Beast have a project they've been working on that has culminated in an application for smartphones, but it's called the Streetlights Bible, and essentially they're taking passages and whole books of scripture and essentially presenting them as creative readings. So they're having different spoken word artists and rappers read through parts and sections and books of the Bible with creative visuals and music behind it. And it's really cool. I'm going to play a clip for you guys from John 1. And this is by some of the guys from Alert 312. But it's really cool.
In the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He existed in the beginning with God. God created everything through Him, and nothing was created except through Him. The Word gave life to everything that was created, and His life brought light to everyone. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness can never extinguish it. God sent a man, John the Baptist, to tell about the light so that everyone might believe because of his testimony.
So yeah, you should check it out. They have a YouTube channel where they put up most of the stuff, and there's also the Streetlights app. If you're into hip-hop and you're into the Bible, I mean, come on. It's
a
great combo.
If you just search Streetlights Bible, there's a website where you can download the tracks and stuff, but I think, from what I understand, they've been working on this for a while and putting out stuff, but I think just recently they came out with the app, Streetlights Bible app, where you can just directly listen to everything, and I assume it'll get updated as they release new stuff.
And honestly, the visuals is really part of the experience. I think you should watch it when you get the opportunity instead of just listening.
The app doesn't have the visuals.
It doesn't?
I've just been listening. I didn't know there were visuals.
Well, go to their YouTube channel.
Ah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I'm gonna do Propagandas also because it's really good.
Which one does he do?
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the deep waters, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness night. And evening passed, and morning came, marking the first day.
So Streetlights Bible, you guys should check it out. It's good stuff. Man, I guess that... Well, no, I do have one other thing I want to say before we wrap it up.
Yeah.
So in just a second, we're going to thank Kingly like we always do. But Logan Miller of Kingly is apparently working on his own podcast. It's going to be coming out relatively soon. I hear they have at least one episode recorded and several on the way that are still in process. But it's a Logan Miller of Kingly and then a local pastor here in St. Louis named David Comstock, who's actually one of the guys... we didn't use clips from it, but I interviewed him for our Hell episode. And so some of his thoughts made it into that episode, even though an interview didn't. But they have a podcast coming out called Rookie, I believe. And I have no clue what it's about, but I love David and I love Logan, so it's got to be good, right? Like, unless they're just, like, talking about baseball stats or something weird, like, it's got to be good. So
here's our blind recommendation, because we love you guys.
Yeah, so we will let you guys know. We'll probably make that a thing of the week or something once the episodes are out and play some clips. But we'll let you guys know once that out. But once that's out, but keep an eye out for it. As we always say, Kingly, thank you for letting us use your awesome music on our crappy podcast. We so desperately need it. Check out Kingly, kinglyofficial.com. They're on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, all that different stuff. Support them. They're local St. Louis dudes who love Jesus and love good music and are trying to put those things together. So give them your support. Man, on that note, I guess I'm going to go read a Four Horsemen of the Atheist Apocalypse book because I'm a heretic.
I guess I'm going to go read a third-rate apologetic response book to one of those guys because I'm a good moral Christian.